Around the world, people are working to bring a greater sense of balance to the planet. Earth Wisdom Circles is here to showcase these people and projects. Now, here's your host for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. As you know, the focus of my show is to help to bring people to the airways that are really making a difference in the world and with the environment, with education, but most importantly, with individuals' lives. And my guest today, Glenn Rader, is one such individual who is helping people to understand how to move through the modern 12 steps of recovery, which is the title of his book, one of his books, to help us navigate this very challenging time that we've gone through, an unprecedented pandemic, and the extraordinary heightening stress that might cause for those who might have a tendency towards addiction of some kind. So welcome to the show, Glenn.
Thank you, Elaine. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. So first of all, give us a little bit of background about yourself, if you would, please.
Well, my educational background is in the corporate finance area. I actually have a degree from the University of Michigan. But about 12 years ago, and I had a successful career in that area, but about 12 years ago, I ran into addiction issues, both drug and alcohol issues. And I was lucky enough to have people around me who cared, people who were willing to put in the time to point me to the resources, and I got myself squared away. And I've been in recovery, active recovery, for 12 years.
Congratulations.
That's great. It's good stuff. And you know, I'm one of those examples that you can do it if you, work an active program of recovery. What I did, though, was I decided to turn my professional talent on helping others. And so I wrote the books. I have a book called Stop, Things You Must Know Before Trying to Help Someone with Addiction, and then a book called Modern 12-Step Recovery. The first book is for family members and friends trying to help someone, and the second book is for the addict and helping that person trying to navigate 12-step recovery in a modern context. Hmm. I work at one of the treatment centers here on a volunteer basis, as does my wife. And other than that, I'm a guy, I golf and have some music hobbies and other things. So that's a little background on myself.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And one of the things that I think is so important, Glenn, is people often have a really skewed misconception of addiction and who might be addicted. So it actually can happen to anyone in any walk of life. It doesn't matter your social strata that you're in, your education level. It's how, throughout your history, not only how you have had to encounter stressors that either were dealt with in a healthy way or an unhealthy way, but also your physiology, what you might have a predisposition to in terms of being perhaps more likely to be addicted because of how your body metabolizes certain things. But right now, as I think is so important, is that we want to prevent people from reacting to their stress. And so as someone who is very immersed and versed in the 12-step program, can you tell us about this modern 12-step recovery program that you write about?
Well, the modern 12-step program that I discuss is really an introduction to the existing AA program. AA hasn't updated their materials for over 80 years, and they've done that intentionally. They've done that so that they don't have to adapt the material to every variation that somebody might want from a religious standpoint or otherwise. The modern 12-step recovery I address is really an introduction to the current AA program, but doing it in a modern context for the modern individual, using cognitive behavioral therapy and what the program does for you. And it includes a modern interpretation of the steps in modern linguistics and things of that nature. I am a big supporter of AA, but the materials haven't been updated for 80 years, and they've done that intentionally so they don't have to adapt it to every context out there, religious preference, personal preference. And it's an interesting strategy. So the modern 12-step recovery that I'm talking to is a more modern view that brings psychology into it and also helps a person to address the stress issues both that they encounter and that they create on their own.
Yes, I think that that's really what I want to talk with you about. Because as an energy healer myself, you know, I see many people that don't understand how their emotional health. And what I mean by that emotional health is what we don't realize is our emotions are giving us information. They're not giving us an identifier.
Right.
And so we often think if we feel something angry, then I must be an angry person. No, maybe what you're feeling angry about is justifiably causing you to be angry because it isn't right or it's offensive or whatever. But right. We as human beings have been taught to dismiss what our emotions are telling us. And as a result of that, we don't then make choices that are driven by what the emotional signal is giving us. So we kind of try to squash it because it's screaming at us the more we ignore it.
Precisely. But and that's at the heart of modern cognitive behavioral therapy. And one of the things I hope to touch on today is driving a person to be a more flexible thinker. We call it cognitive flexibility because it helps reduce what's called thinking errors. It's at the center of it. Most people struggling with self-esteem issues, depression, and addiction look at the world through inflexible eyes. They grab onto that emotion and run with it and let it identify themselves and things of that nature. So what we're trying to do with the people I work with today in the addiction area is to, the number one thing we're working on is trying to get them to be a more flexible thinker. And part of that is to not let their emotions drive their thinking and let them be more flexible in their addressing stressors in the area. And I can talk to that directly if you'd like.
Sure, but what that comes to mind is, you know, sometimes we use language that seems very academic. And I think that sometimes we have to get to more modern vernaculars. And to me, cognitive flexibility means the willingness to learn. And because learning is an ongoing building and changing and giving ourselves the gift of observing something and then perhaps changing what we believed to be true so that we can broaden that understanding.
Right on the money. And the way we describe it is it's made up of several key points. One is learning to suspend judgment, getting the person to suspend judgment. You know, I used to be pretty quick on the trigger. You know, I'd put my boxing gloves on and lay into somebody, you know. So number one is learning to suspend judgment, just becoming a person, putting the pause button on long enough to where you're not jumping in. Number two is developing the ability, and this gets into the learning, to weigh evidence, to consider options. A lot of people go into situations with a predetermined outcome, and they latch onto it. That would be second. Third thing is trying to look at having preferences rather than absolutes, and that's a learning feature too.
Right.
You know, go into things with a flexible thought about, and think of it as, I would rather have this as a preference for the outcome, that it's not something that I have to have and that I have to be demanding about, and that if you don't give it to me, you don't love me, and that adds the stress. There's another element of it is being skeptical of your first thoughts. People who are dealing with addiction or dealing with stressors in their lives, they start packaging things up and they have packaged responses to everything. So we try to encourage people to pause long enough to challenge their first thoughts. And last and very important is training yourself to be the observer. We call it being the observer.
Yes.
And the observer is a person who learns to observe their thoughts and, like you led off with, observe their emotions.
Yes.
And you almost become two people in that context, the thinking person and the person observing the thinking person. It's actually a part of 2,500-year-old Buddhism.
Right.
So those are the components of becoming more flexible and more of a learning person, but you have to do it, learn to do it real time. You have to train yourself, and I had to practice it. Part of my path out of addiction was becoming a more flexible thinker. And it really pays off, but you have to practice it, because if you've been doing it 50 years, you're not going to turn the switch on.
Right, right. Well, I think that what we have an opportunity when we really begin to change our world and understand the capacity for us to be peaceful individuals. And peacefulness does not mean lethargic. I think many people think that if you're peaceful, you're meditating for hours on end. To be peaceful means you have the capacity to take benevolent action.
Yes.
Inclusive action, joyful action.
Yes.
And I think that we've been, unfortunately, corralled, if I could use that term, into thinking that there is a right and a wrong exclusively. So we make ourselves right, or we make ourselves wrong, or we make someone else right or someone else wrong based on what we presume to believe. That doesn't mean we actually know it.
Right. Excellent point. We talk a lot about growing up in the United States, or growing up in our culture, and wanting to be right all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other side of that is you get yourself in a frame of mind that you're wrong all the time. But I grew up thinking that winning, getting ahead, being right, you know, being in charge was what I was supposed to do. So I went after everything with boxing. I mentioned that earlier. I went out in the world with boxing gloves on every day.
Right, right.
You know, out for a sparring and a good spar and a win. Somehow thinking that if I win all the time and I'm right all the time, that I'll end up ending up on the top of the human being stack, when it's quite the opposite. I need to be kind and loving.
And, yes.
And like you described, in the addiction community, we refer to it as serenity, achieving a state of serenity, which just means an ability to calmly deal with what's coming at you. In your terms, calmly deal at the stressors. And on the other side of that, don't treat a nice day like every day has to be a nice day. You know, you go outside. A Buddhist monk one time said, I was sitting in a session, Harvard-educated Buddhist monk sitting there going, he said, you know, it was a beautiful day yesterday, but I don't have to judge future days based on that beautiful day. You know, he was making a great point.
Mm-hmm.
But he was talking about serenity's ability to deal with the good as well as the stressors coming at you.
Right. I have a friend who is a funeral director. And he always wisely says, every day is a good day when you're on this side of the earth's ground. You know, so it's, you know, what we have this false belief that we have to be judges. And, you know, rather than appreciative of what life is offering.
Oh, yeah, very well put.
Yeah.
Very well put.
So tell me, as you had mentioned to me that you're in our private conversation, I don't believe that you said it yet, but that your book is being used in various recovery programs. And how have people, how has this helped people to be kinder to themselves? Would you say?
I'm going to reach behind me and grab the first one. This is not for shameless promotion. It's just to
it's
use
okay.
it.
It's okay. You can shamelessly promote. There's no shame in promoting.
No, it's to use it as a prop here.
Okay.
But the first book is called Stop, Things You Must Know Before Trying to Help Someone with Addiction. It's it's intentionally a very short book. It's designed for the person, the family member or friend who has a person in their family who's struggling with addiction. And the way the book directly helps with the issue you're talking about is it subtracts out from their thinking that they're responsible for all of this, particularly parents. It helps take out, there's the middle section of the book is called Misguided Beliefs. And they're misguided beliefs that people carry in their heads about their role in the addiction that create a lot of stress. Some people, I think, there's a statistic out there somewhere that the average family takes about 10 years to take action with an addict. Between denial, feeling that they're responsible in some way, what we call misdirected love, killing them with kindness. And so the book helps, STOP helps to bring it to the person, to the family member, so that they can understand addiction for what it really represents, what you led off with, which is a physical illness, actually some genetics, and then the psychological side that they pick up through their environment and along the way. So STOP is, and STOP's used at the treatment center here locally with the family program I mentioned to you. And they like it because of that, because it's short and because it gives them some artillery to do, for addressing the addiction in a kind and loving way and with facts rather than going at it with boxing gloves and trying to beat the person into submission, get them out of their addiction. And it's been very effective with that. I'm very proud of it. I did it not as a profit-making venture. It was to help the family members out. I've been involved in that program at the Maple Grove Treatment Center here in Michigan for about 9 years. And my wife has been involved in it for 13 years and got involved in it early on. And then that led to me getting inpatient treatment for my addiction.
So correct me if I'm wrong. And again, my guest is Glenn Rader, who is an author of two books about addiction and helping those that we love or that we're surrounded by in whatever relationship that might be, how to help them and help ourselves at the same time. Because correct me if I'm wrong, Glenn, but there is an Al-Anon program that is kind of for those individuals who are maybe not the alcoholic themselves or the drug addict themselves, but their life is so entangled in the actions of someone else that their life spins out of control when they're, perhaps inadequately educated or emotionally maybe just exhausted. And how do you deal with somebody that is not only just, I think that there's things that happen when people have a physical addiction. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, that there is not only the physical addiction, but there's often an emotional outburst that is affecting those that are around that individual. So there's layers of abuse of not only the physical abuse of a substance, but the emotional abuse that can occur when someone is an addict because everyone else's life has to change or changes as a result of the choice.
Yep. Absolutely. First, Al-Anon, the Al-Anon organization is the counterpart to AA, and the Al-Anon organization works exactly the same 12 steps that they do in AA.
Oh, okay.
Because everything beyond the first step, which is admitting you're powerless over the substance, and in the case of Al-Anon, you're powerless over the addict. But the rest of the steps are all personal development steps. That have to do with accepting help from the outside, taking a personal inventory, getting to know yourself and understand yourself. So they want the people on the family side that participate in Al-Anon to get to know themselves. It's not an education in an addict. It's an education in the way they interact with the addict. And so the people who attend the family program, at the treatment center at Maple Grove, they are also encouraged to join Al-Anon as part of their ongoing process to get what they call a sponsor, somebody who works with them on the steps, gives them a sounding board for ideas and things. But the emotional part, if you eliminate the alcohol from the picture and from the addict and eliminate the codependency part from the family side of the house, what you're both dealing with is interaction, emotions, and things of that nature. Because I think that the addict and their family members and friends have a real distorted inner relationship, a relationship going from an emotional standpoint, because the people want to help the addict so bad that they go about it, hammering away at it. And on the addiction side, they would really like some quick fix help for this thing, but they're not going to get it. And they have to learn that it comes through being patient and working through the program.
And sometimes I think it's out of desperation, it's sometimes you don't necessarily know that you even want to help. You just want it to stop.
Oh,
you know, you don't want the abuse of any form to continue. Yeah.
No, so, if I can be blunt, you just want the crazy shit in your household to stop.
Yes.
You know, you're living in a chaotic situation. You got somebody who's craving drugs and or alcohol, and there's crazy things going on, including we address that partly in STOP, which has to do sometimes with them starting to steal from you and protecting your assets and things like that. So we.
And there's many kind of thievery. There is the stealing of someone's self-esteem. There is the stealing of someone's personal space. It's not just a physical stealing of an object. You know,
And if I were rewriting the book today, I would add what you just said to that section.
Mm.
Because it's largely, I address that subject in other parts of it. When I'm talking about protecting your assets, one of those assets you could protect are your emotional assets. Right. I do that in another part of the book because we talk about setting boundaries and not enabling bad behavior, which allows that to persist in the house.
Right.
And then rob you as the individual with your serenity and self-esteem to the point where the person, the family member, can end up in a worse emotional state than the addict.
Yes. Yes. Because
of being robbed by what you just said.
Yes. You know, and I think fundamentally, Glenn, that we really are in, because this, we have experienced this global pandemic, we are globally, not just singularly, looking at the challenges that we as a human species have created.
Correct.
We have created many of the stressors, or probably all these stressors, with the exception of a natural disaster like flooding and those things that are out of our control. But I think fundamentally we have to change how do we begin to educate people and give them knowledge that can become wisdom. How do we help businesses no longer be brutes?
Right.
You know, because I'm sure you have seen, as having been in executive positions, you probably have seen people that maybe were functioning alcoholics, but were using one form of power over another to, just as you were saying, this power play that creates this thievery of someone's time, their joy, their whatever.
Yeah,
I think we have to change a lot.
We do. And I think it's a topic today in corporate America more than it ever has been, perhaps because of the competition for people, the changing work environment of more remote working, just a number of factors that they have to have that dialogue. And I think they're having more of it, is changing the approach that executives and managers and leaders and the people take to their workspace, to making it less stressful.
Yes.
On the subject of creating stress in your life, I can bring one subject to the table, which is something that I could bring many, but there's one that is one of my favorites, which is we talk about developing emotional maturity.
Mm-hmm.
It's called emotional sobriety, actually, by the founder, Bill Wilson of AA. But later on, there's some people like Alan Berger and some people in the space. He's a PhD in the recovery space. That deals with emotional sobriety, and this is the center of it. This is how we can reduce the stressors in our life, is by detaching ourselves from people for our emotional well-being. That is, stop seeking validation, stop taking things personally, you know, and then when people aren't providing you good vibes all the time and giving you compliments or supporting what you're saying, you take it as a criticism of yourself. You take it personally. And we have found that people who have the ability to detach, and I'm not saying become aloof, just like you were talking about earlier, we're talking about just a different way of dealing with people. So I try to encourage people, and we try to encourage people to detach from others for their well-being. Don't look to people, places, or things to drive your self-worth and self-esteem. And it really works. And what that means is being objective. I'm going to give you the workplace example. I've got a good one because you brought
Please.
It up.
Okay.
Please. So I'm at work. I've been given an assignment at work. And the manager reviews it and they say to me, they say, Glenn, I need you to do that over. That doesn't meet the objectives of the program, or it's not meeting that one government regulation or something else like that. Now, me as an employee, I can take that two different ways. I can actually take it in a combination too. One of those ways I can take it is, I didn't do my job correctly. I have an obligation here. They pay me a paycheck. I did miss that. Thank you. I'll fix that up and I'll get back with you, you know, Mrs. Smith, or, you know, my leader, let's say. And the other way I can take that is, they don't like me. Mm-hmm. They don't like me. They think I make mistakes and I'm a bad person. We often talk about this, like a person makes a mistake at work and by the time they get home, they're a bad person. You know, all they did with, and so that's the essence of kind of detaching from things for your emotional sobriety and emotional maturity and serenity, is don't take things from that dimension, particularly where you have obligations. If you've said to somebody, I'm going to do this, let's say my sister, and I say, I'm going to do this, and I don't do it, well, I have to take a role in that. And if they say, you didn't do that, I need to go, I'm sorry, I didn't do that, but I shouldn't be thinking, they think I'm no good, I'm a no good, not, I don't follow up on things, and then start to tag themselves with that. And we think that a lot of the stressors come from taking things personally and pulling your environment for validation that you're a good person. Mm-hmm. And if you learn to detach from that, it's amazing. We've seen people kind of transform when they, I had a therapist one time say that to a group, he said, you know, people just don't give a shit about you as much as you think they do.
Right.
They're all, you know, and the reality is they're all walking around thinking about themselves and what you're thinking about me. You see
right.
what I'm saying?
Right.
So that's one aspect of it. As a matter of fact, what I'm describing, again, is at the center of 2,500-year-old Buddhism. They call it clinging. In Buddhism, you suffer. This is the center of Buddhism. You suffer because you cling.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're doing is clinging to others, clinging to material objects, clinging to the main ideology of your environment, like the man is supposed to be in charge, in control. And you cling to those things and you suffer because you're not living up to them. And what
right.
they can encourage you to do in Buddhism is to let go of the clinging.
Well, what we understand in healing is that suffering is emotional. Mm-hmm. Pain is physical. Pain can be often mitigated and managed.
Very well put.
And pain is an identifier that something is wrong in the body, to intentionally bring your attention so that something can be corrected, a cut or a burn or a wound or something, so that we know, wait a minute, there's a problem with this physical body that needs attention. But suffering is the endless tumbling of the trouble in the mind.
Right.
And one of the things I think that we have an opportunity to do to really begin to mitigate and make it less likely that people fall into a habit of addiction is to really start to build within a family, beginning with children, what does it mean to be a leader? So to be a leader means you are encouraging others to be their best selves. You're not saying follow my way exclusively. And as we do that, we have an opportunity to look at, in since you are in the business world, I think that it's really important that we recognize the language that we use. And in leadership roles, in particular in business leadership roles, they have stolen a term that is misunderstood greatly, and that is the term chief.
Right.
So there is chief medical officer, chief executive officer, without understanding that that term chief comes from the indigenous world.
Right, right.
And to be a chief is a pledge of leadership, not an appointment of leadership. A pledge.
It is the titles like chief and boss and, you know, things like that. But, you know, we tried to avoid that in my areas. You know, I tried to encourage people, just think of me as one of the team. I'm one of the team, and I have a different role than you do.
Yes.
I coordinate work. I try to keep things on track, make your workspace reasonable, let you set it up so that you can go home on the weekends and we're not here till midnight every night working. But that's my role on the team. It's not that,
right.
Like you said, it's not the leader where I bring in the hammer and say, get going, you know, get going,
right.
get that thing done. If you don't get it done, you'll end up on the bottom of the employee stack in cultivating that kind of environment. We do need to do a lot more in the business world to get rid of the chiefs and bosses and any other kind of acronym of that nature.
Yeah.
I never thought about the word chief from that perspective, and it's really
I've had the great privilege of working with Indigenous elders, and there's so much that has been taken from the great wisdom of living with life, which is what they knew and know how to do, not to try to control life. And the controlling of life is what is unmanageable and creates these desires for addiction, whether that's physical, emotional, sexual, whatever that addiction might be.
Yeah.
It we're out of sync with life is what we need to understand. And how do we get back in sync with life so that we can actually live it joyfully?
Right.
My guest is Glenn Rader. And Glenn, can you tell me how you have seen this pandemic affect people's ability to cope or not? Or has this heightened, or has it, what has it done, this uncertainty?
Well, I can talk to it from the standpoint of what's going on in the recovery community and how impacted that directly.
Please.
One is we went from having in-person meetings of all types, whether they're Al-Anon, AA, other development meetings, went to the Zoom environment.
Right.
So they're not person to person anymore. And I actually have a two-pronged view of that, because there were some good things that came out of it.
Sure.
One is, I think it's better if you can be in person with people just trying to get help with their addiction. They can see the real people. They can see good people that are recovering, that have some years of sobriety under their belt and recovery. That's healthy. The same way it is in business. It's the same, you know, same thing. And in your work, it's nice if you can meet people, you know, face to face. It has the human element. But the other side of that is the Zoom environment has expanded our reach to people needing help.
Yes.
For example, weekly, we are on a Zoom meeting with the people that are inpatients at the treatment center. And they meet a lot of people in that context fast. They get sponsors, so when they get out, they can get sponsored and things of that nature. So some real good things have gone on there. For example, you can do a Zoom meeting now. You can do an AA meeting in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can participate. There are meetings where people participate, and there'll be people from England, Japan, all in the same meeting.
Yes.
It expands your horizon of just seeing other people who struggle with the same thing. I know in terms of the number of people with psychological issues and addiction issues, it has accelerated at the pandemic.
Yes.
Because of the isolation, not having the personal interface, and you turn in then, you get inside your head and start living more that virtual world in your head, I think. That's my way of describing it. And so it's been negative in that sense. I don't have statistics on the number of calls for psychiatric help or calls for addiction help, but I would imagine it's been greatly increased over the last year or so.
Hmm. Well, with the, obviously not to betray any anonymity, but You know, would you say that people are stressed because of the fact that they are working alone, or that they are now perhaps having childcare as their primary responsibility in child education rather than having the school help them or a daycare help them or a spouse help them or whatever, you know, or family member? Is there those added challenges that we are facing now that are kind of putting people, tipping them over the edge of not exactly knowing what to do, so they reach for a substance to quiet their distress?
I cannot talk to that directly. First of all, I'm not working from home. I'm retired, and what I do is, so I don't have the demands of the corporate environment or anything of that nature. Number two, I don't have children, so they don't have children that I'm in touch with regularly. What I would tell you is my friends that have children and people who are working at home, they've had to adapt to a dimension of things that has added stress to them. Mm-hmm. And I can see the ones that are dealing with it well and the other ones that are more, I haven't seen anybody directly turn to drugs or alcohol.
Good.
Because of it. But I'm confident that it's going on out there. I mean, sure. It would make sense. You know, you're at home alone, you're stressed out, you know, and also the having children at home and working at home at the same time would be a real challenge.
Yes, yes. You know, what comes to my mind, and I don't know if this is ever addressed by the AA organization or those in the positions to have these conversations, but so many times in advertising, alcohol is glamorized. You know, that, you know, you have the best cognac and you're going to be the happiest guy in the world, or you have this best beer and, you know, you're supporting the underdog because this comes from a particular place or whatever. You know, what responsibility do you think, if any, does those who provide the product, obviously I'm talking about the legal substance of alcohol, what responsibility do they have in your mind? Not as an expert, but in someone that is successfully been through the program. There's outside interference, that outside noise that says, oh yeah, you want to have a good time, have this beer.
It directly, I'll answer it a couple of ways. Number one, what you just said directly relates to this issue of detaching from things. It's hard to detach from things as a person when you have the media coming at you with booze. Like, booze is going to make you, people who drink booze feel better and they're happier. That's what they're projecting. Mm-hmm. Like Eric Clapton said, Eric Clapton's done an open talk that's out there on YouTube. And he said that he lived in this kind of dreary town, but that all the adults would go into this building every weekend and get happy. And that's what he wanted.
In the pubs, right?
The pubs, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think they have a responsibility for projecting it as something that you have to have, that you're happier. But on the other side of that, we live in a capitalist society.
Yes.
That allows people to promote their products within reason. And we as individuals have to learn to not look at that as if it's fact.
Yes.
For example, if I don't have that car, I'm not going to be happy, and that's a fact. Or if I don't dress like that and look like her or him and wear the Hugo Boss, or I'm not making that up, you know, that I'm not going to be happy. So it not only happens with alcohol, it's happening with clothes, watches, houses, food. If I don't have that and I start clinging to that notion, I'm not happy. And so we as individuals have to learn to look at that booze ad and go, those guys are really just promoting the booze, you know, they're and almost with a sense of humor. Or look at that beach, they're going down the beach with those clothes on and they're talking about those clothes. The ads are almost have a sense of humor about them if you look at it critically, not critically, yes, but objectively.
Yes, yes, yes. So tell me, what was the biggest turning point for you personally, since you have openly said that you had you know, you had been in recovery wonderfully. You know, what was the, if you don't mind my asking, what was the turning point for you to say, I need to change this? What was the moment, or what was the incident, if you could share? Because I think people need to say, well, this, if he can do it, I can do it. And if this was the stressor that triggered him, maybe I can see that as my own as well.
There's a couple things. William James, who is like the father of American psychology, he wrote a book called Varieties of Religious Experiences. And it's really not religion he's talking about. He's talking about the human experience of getting a wholeness and seeking to be a better person and things like that. But in there, he hit, and this was a book that Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, read when he was an inpatient. And I've studied it and read it, but he says it real well. You have to reach a point of desperation to where you're willing to sacrifice your ego. You know, turn your ego off. And what he means by that is turn your pride off and everything for the willingness. And I'll take it back to what you said earlier, the willingness to learn and to take outside direction to change yourself. For me, what was the change for me? There's two things. One is I was increasing my use of drugs and alcohol. I was using prescription drugs that I could scrounge up. I was drinking alcohol and smoking weed. But, you know, and I started to feel, there were two things. I started to feel insane. I'd never caused a car accident. I hadn't, my financial situation is sound, but I started to lose it, and my wife started to see it. I became isolated and alone. And what happened is she did an intervention on me at the right time. She'd been attending the family group out at Maple Grove. She did an intervention on me. And I was positioned, because of my desperation and the pending consequences and current consequences, to get outside the box and just listen. And that was a turning point for me. I started to listen to 100% of what they told me at the medical people, the psychological people, the treatment center, the people in AA, and didn't question them. Meaning I didn't allow the addicted personality to question it. And that was a turning point for me. And what the unfortunate thing is, and I talked to it actually in both books, is that some people don't reach that point of desperation. And you know why they don't? Because the consequences aren't great enough. Their consequences aren't great enough. They think, oh, I got a job. I haven't killed anybody yet driving. I got no DUIs. And they keep going. And the other side of that is the loved ones around them don't set any boundaries. They don't create consequences for them. Yes. For example, as a kid, if you don't adhere to these rules in the house, and if you're, or as a 20-year-old, and if you don't adhere to the rules in the house, and if you don't, and if you're in our house high or stoned, then you're going to have to move out. And we don't care where you go. I mean, it gets to that point in some cases. That's not everybody's path, but the people will get to the point where they create boundaries and create logical consequences that wakes the person up. If you let the kid, for example, if you let a kid, I say a kid, you know, I'm approaching 70, but if I say a kid, like 20-year-old person, if you let them live in your basement and play video games and smoke weed just because you don't want to make them feel bad, then they aren't experiencing the consequences. They'll never become desperate, and the switch will never turn on that they have to do something. Some people go as far as actually taking the 20-year-old kid and giving them to, like, I mean, you know, Salvation Army or a treatment center, or giving them a list, but not allowing them to live in the house any longer. And the kid will wake up. There are many other avenues for that. But right. So the turning point for me was that reaching a point of desperation, but then listening to the people outside of me.
You know, you mentioned something about the founder of AA speaking about it being a religious experience or a religious awareness. And I often try to ask people to look beyond that, because we don't realize how much harm religion has done.
Well, I should restate what I, if you picked it up that way, because Bill Wilson, although the 12 steps has a spiritual feel to it and has the word God's in it, and that he per se, he was fairly agnostic. Okay. And so was William James in his own way. William James was not talking about the religious side of getting desperate, but rather the psychological side of getting desperate.
Well, I think that what's important is to understand that we are spirit.
Yeah, that we are spirits.
So when we have a spiritual, quote unquote, spiritual experience, we have an awareness that we are bigger and a part of this majesty called life.
Exactly.
Then we have an understanding that this is the most extraordinary gift we will ever have, which is our life.
Yes, and actually, because of the wording of the 12 steps, I'm going to grab this other book for a second.
Please.
Because of the wording of the 12 steps, the thing that turns a modern audience off to them most is the religious tone to them. They were written in the 30s, and there's a lot of damage done for the modern audience, particularly the young people. The statistic is now, and this comes out of a Pew Research study, that around 40% of the people born after 1990 don't have a concept of a metaphysical being or a entity or anything of that nature. And I'm not talking about they're not spiritual. They can be spiritual people. But if you walk up to them and say, read one of the steps, you know, from the current 12 steps that says, you know, turn yourself, you know, get a God of your understanding, the word God to them doesn't even translate. So part of what this is modern 12-step recovery. You can see on the cover, it says updated steps, support from science and psychology, and practical guidance. Well, the steps that are in the book, and they're true to the AA steps in every way, they just have the religious element of it extracted from them so that you're allowed to have whatever resource you want, whether it's the medical community or the religious community or whatever you like. And number two, they're reworded to modern language because the stuff written in the 30s has a little, you know, it's a little antiquated. But there's a lot of damage done in the modern recovery environment by people who take these verbatim and preach religion with this 12 steps. And so this book is written for the modern person, you know, to give them entry to the space of 12-step recovery without the burden of the religious component.
Well, that's helpful, I think. So Glenn, again, my guest is Glenn Rader. Glenn, what is the best way for people to find your books, and what is the best way for people to reach you personally if they would like to talk with you? Are you amenable to that? And if you speak to different organizations, how might people reach you? First of all, how did they get your books?
Well, the books are available on Amazon exclusively. I use that because they have a great distribution network. They print on demand.
Right.
So, you know, they print on demand, great distribution network. So you can get those both. And I think on the bottom of some information I sent you, I think there's links there, and you could use those two links if you
like.
And post those for your listeners. The best way to get a hold of me is... to get a hold of me at info@mazepublishing.com. And I would encourage you to, if you can print that out or.
Okay.
That
is that M-A-Z-E or?
M-A-Z-E publishing.com.
Okay,
so
good.
info@mazepublishing.com. I try to take everything related to the books and my recovery through that.
Good.
So it doesn't get mixed up with my personal activity and the other.
Of course. Of course. Well, that's really good. So, in relation to, as we're changing, as we're coming out of COVID, or, you know, who knows what we'll be encountering, because we really never know truly what we're going to encounter every day anyways, what is the thing that you have found that is the spark that helps people recognize their own worth and their own dignity?
That's a great question. I think there's a couple things. For me, I'll take it for myself, that helps elevate my spiritual side and helps elevate me personally. One has been just, and I've tried to do this throughout the pandemic, keep in touch with the outdoors. and the beauty around you.
Right.
You know, we have wonderful parks here, and in many, all over the United States, of course, and all over the world. There are wonderful parks where you can go take walks and keep yourself energized, stay physically fit, you know, get out there and do things. That's been something I've tried to do throughout the pandemic. But I think it's important we start interfacing with people again, as much as you can. Face-to-face interaction with people. For example, now we've opened up face-to-face AA meetings in several places.
Good.
And some of the other sessions outside of AA that I'm involved in. So the spark for me coming out of the pandemic is you have to go out and start engaging. Don't wait for it to engage with you. And maybe even go a little further than you were pre-pandemic. Listen to some of Elaine's podcasts and, you know, the spiritual, but really, I mean that, listen, get the spiritual lift of that side of things, the earth wisdom. Go out and make some efforts to lift your spirits by developing yourself, you know. But certainly you can go out there and start doing some detaching, like we talked about. Just start detaching from things. Don't expect the environment to uplift you. Go out and engage. Go become involved.
I think that one of the things that when I'm asking individuals, when people ask me as a healer, you know, how do I help to change or how do I get out of this mindset? I think that we have to ask ourselves one very fundamental and direct question. Is that true? So whatever we are told by somebody, we have the opportunity to stop, assess, what's called fall back, which means step back a little bit so you have greater perspective. If there's a problem and someone needs to be identified as the person in charge, go to that person in charge. If you're the one in charge, you make the statement of whatever needs to be said. And the first question we have to ask ourselves is that true? Do I have to be angry? Do I have to believe this particular thing that is history, old history? Or can I just stop and say, is there another choice?
And what you described was Elaine's version, I mean, or your description of cognitive flexibility, of thinking flexibility, the willingness. And at the center of that is to question things and not treat everything as a fact.
Right.
As a fact, your sister says to you, you know, you look like hell today. You might not look like hell today. She might feel like hell today. I'm using that as just an example.
And what does hell look like anyways?
What does hell look like anyways? But it's right at the center of it is questioning things and don't treat things as fact. It is in fact that you're going to be happy if you drink that glass of Chivas Regal.
Right.
Oh, as a matter of fact, I saw about the Duke of Argyle on PBS yesterday was showing off because he's a spokesperson for Chivas Regal, and they have 20 bottles of Chivas Regal that are $200,000 a piece. And how glamorous can you get? Are you supposed to believe that that's better than the cheap booze? I don't know. But it's like taking things as fact, like looking at that and going, that's fact. That must be the best stuff.
Instead of holding next to it one pure glass of water.
That is
the only thing that can keep you alive.
You know, it's at the center of what you're talking about is questioning things and being a flexible thinker, looking at options.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that I want to thank you, and it was very serendipitous how we met, and that's how my life is. When you're meant to meet somebody, you're going to meet them, and there you go. And I'm really grateful for that opportunity. I'm grateful for what you do, for your honesty, and I think that it takes a lot of courage and a lot of leadership, not just courage, but leadership, to say, yeah, I went through this too. Yeah, right. My life might look great, but I had some bumps in the road, and my life is great now because I've recognized what I was doing that was harming this only self that I have.
Right on the money.
I think that that is so vitally important. We just have a few more minutes left. So where do you want to take this further? Glenn? Where do you want to take what your deep knowledge is even further?
Well, what I'm trying to do now is make sure that the literature, you know, the two books that I've written for the community, get out there and are made available to people so that the treatment centers are aware of them, so that the recovery community is aware of them. And I have people that support me in that. And again, I'm not out for it as this isn't to make money. I just know that I can put my talent into something where I can really help people.
No shame in making money, because then you can reinvest that into what you're trying to do.
Oh, I have no shame in it. No, I have no shame in it. It's just that it's not the driver for doing it.
Yes.
It's more of a, it starts out as a creative process of taking and assimilating knowledge, being able to boil it down for consumption by an audience, keeping it short and brief. And that's the real reward for me, is having somebody to say, that's the best book for a family I've ever written or I've ever read. And they did that at the local treatment center. The person who runs the program, she told me that's the best book she'd ever read on the subject for families.
Wonderful.
That's the reward. So, no, I have no shame about earning money. Do you?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, it's a tool for life.
It's a tool. Use it as a tool. And it's been a pleasure. I enjoy the discussion. This is the space I enjoy.
Well, could you tell the names of your two books and where they can get in touch with that, or where they can find them?
The first one is Stop, Things You Must Know Before Trying to Help Someone with Addiction. And this is for the family members and friends. It's a short book that arms you with things that sometimes takes people 10 years to learn and at great emotional and financial expense.
Mm-hmm.
It's available on Amazon. Just if you search Stop by Glenn Rader. And the second book is Modern 12-Step Recovery. And this book is for the person seeking recovery, and it gives them a modern introduction to the 12-step program and describes what the steps do to you from a psychology standpoint, from a cognitive behavioral standpoint, and then provides you a working program in the back for working the 12 steps and working with your sponsor. That's also available on Amazon. And if you Google Modern 12-Step Recovery by Glenn Rader, I appreciate you, allowing me to share that with people, because it helps me get it to a broader audience.
Good, good. Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Glenn Rader. This is Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles. Remember that every choice you make can make this life better for not only yourself, but for everyone, so that we can live joyful, inclusive, creative, loving lives. That's what life should be. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you, Elaine.